Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone executive editor Nathan Brackett. For this episode, we're going to do a very special expanded version of what we're listening to, devoted entirely to the new Radiohead album. We're also going to talk to Rolling Stone contributing editor Mark Benelli about his new book, Screamin' Jay Hawkins' All-Time Greatest Hits. We're also going to do reader mail about the new version of Blink 182. But first, today's episode of Rolling Stone Music Now is brought to you by Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer at home. So sign up for Stamps.com and get a 4-week trial and $110 bonus offer when you use the promo code MUSIC. Different types of and we're back. That was Desert Island Disc that we were just listening to, and we're going to talk about the new Radiohead album, their first record in 5 years, A Moon-Shaped Pool. I'm here with staff writer Andy Green.
Hi.
And senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Hello.
Thanks for coming, guys.
Sure.
Let's get right into it. How is this record stacking up against other Radiohead records? Andy, 25-word review. We gave it 4.5 stars on Rolling Stone.
I think that's very fair. I need more time to process it. I've thoroughly enjoyed my first 6 or 7 listens. It's a very mellow record.
For me, the thing that jumped out is just that there's a lot of acoustic guitar on this record. There's strings. There's a lot of acoustic stuff on this record. Maybe more than I've ever heard on a Radiohead record. Tom York will do acoustic songs. They'll do acoustic sets live.
Right.
But this is a gorgeous record.
Yeah, it's been great to hear Johnny Greenwood's orchestrations that he's been doing on his movies for the past few years to be sort of fused into the world of Radiohead.
Right.
Which is a very nice change from the last album, which was great, but it was very electronic. And this feels more organic at times.
Well, I mean, every Radiohead record, I guess, either since like Kid A or I guess to some degree, OK Computer, has had varying degrees of electronics, you know, probably driven, this is a huge generalization, but by like Tom York and who's a huge electronic music fan. And of course, like the classic, you know, rock fan beef against Radiohead since the Bends, which is almost a cliche now, has been like, when are they going to make a great guitar rock record? When is this going to happen? And so I kind of love the perversity of this record in the sense that this could be their most guitar rock record in years or guitar driven record, but it's an acoustic record.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like
I totally disagree. I don't think it's much less guitar driven than Hell to the Thief or like it's not a guitar driven record at all. I think it's orchestrally driven. I think what you mean. I think what you're trying to. I think what puts you in that mental space is the fact that it's orchestral and song-driven. It's song-driven, but it's not guitar.
Fair
there
enough.
Are moments when
Fair
the guitars enough. Come up, but less so even than
like
Hell
to tuneful,
the Thief.
Yeah.
Tuneful, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I think it's more of like this moody, kind of beautiful, extremely arranged, extremely orchestrated thing with, yes, some guitars coming in and out, you know, but I don't see it as a guitar record.
I just feel like the guitars like do have a prominent role that you haven't heard. Like I feel like even with Hail to the Thief, there are definitely riffs in there, but like
even in Rainbows, I don't know. Yeah, I just don't. Yeah, I don't buy this angle. Right. Basically, I just don't quite. What do you think, Andy, on the guitar level?
I hear guitars on it, but it's not quite like Hail to the Thief. I would agree with you, or definitely not like their '90s work at all. But yeah, no, it's very orchestral. That's what jumps out at me
for sure.
And what's great is
tuneful,
definitely. Yeah. What's cool is they give it to you with no context. There's no liner notes. There's no interviews. There's no lyrics. It just here's the album, which is pretty cool. It just allows you to sort of digest it yourself without having to have any other information about it. We're presuming that it was Johnny Greenwood that was doing a lot of the symphonic stuff, but there's no way to even know that. I mean, there's just no information.
It's possible that they won't do any interviews around this record. We'll find out.
Yeah, which would not be annoying at all, right?
No, not at all.
At all.
Not at all.
To me, the biggest question is how they got here. How they got here from the last album, and when they said they were totally uninterested in, they told David Frick they were totally uninterested in writing traditional songs. They specifically said, we don't want to sit down and write a chord progression and then do a vocal, which is basically like, in other words, we don't want to write a song. That's, I mean, you know, right. Like they wanted to do something, you know, they were sampling the instruments and then layering them and then singing over it. It was a totally different, you know, it was even probably more radical. King of Limbs was even more radical in its methods than Kid A or anything. So now they have this big traditional songwriting driven album, which includes, you know, ancient songs, which include True Love Waits.
Well, yeah, well, let's talk about that. Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, this is a song that they've been playing live. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a song they started playing in the mid-90s on the Benz tour. It was on their live album from 01. I'll drown my beliefs. So this has been a part of their universe since almost the very beginning, and they finally decided to put it on an album.
Have there been any songs that have had this long an incubation period for them?
For them? No.
No, this is the kind of holy grail song for fans. Fans have been obsessed with this song. They already know what all the lyrics are about, and they've made, it's kind of hilarious. I could watch an entire documentary about just their hilarious number of attempts to record this song. Because what they said, I think, to us was they could have recorded this song and made it sound like, quote, a John Mayer song. That's what Nigel Godrich said. And it's a very simple song. It was a simple acoustic song.
Right.
And so they have been beating themselves up for, how many years is it since 1995?
It's been 21 years.
For 21 years trying to find an acceptable recording of this song. And, you know, I think at one point there were 56 takes in the mid-2000s. So just, you know, and then eventually there was this new keyboard-driven version that he played live a few times. And now this version takes it from acoustic guitar to keyboards. I'll try. I like it very much. Do you like it? Does it live up to the live version for you?
Yeah, I think it's great. It's almost slower even. It's sort of haunting. And in the context of Tom's divorce, too, it almost takes on a whole new meaning now, as do many songs on this album, possibly.
Oh, my God. Was it a divorce, or were they married?
Well, they're at least separated. Tom York.
They've been together about 25 years. I mean, it's a really long relationship.
You just touched the third rail here. I don't know.
Right.
The whole podcast is going to dissolve into Radiohead static and turn back.
No, it's unavoidable, though. I mean, this is a song that they wrote a couple decades ago, and it definitely means something different when, you know, the guy who wrote it now lives apart from his significant from his significant other.
We can talk about it. They announced in a press release. This is public information.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I mean, if you want to go there is in Daydreaming, there's this backwards masked part of this thing at the end. There's this weird backwards vocal. It's played backwards and pitch shifted, but
we're getting into some serious Beatles White Album.
That's a big part of the song. It's that big refrain at the end. It's repeated over and over again. So of course, Radiohead fans have flipped it forward and, you know, deep pitch shifted. And he's saying half my life, half my life, half my life.
Which was
he's 47, you know. They were married 23 years, so you can do the math.
Now that we're kind of into like the speculation zone, like Andy, you were also talking about some of like the online chatter about how this could be their last album. People saying like, okay, they're like, was it you? Maybe it wasn't you.
I think this is an idea I invented yesterday.
All right, this is a pure invention. Let's just go down this road as a thought exercise.
Yeah, okay.
If you were going to make a last record, it would make sense that you might pull out songs that were old that you've been trying to get right for years. This does have some of that wistful, you know, last record feel. I'm almost like, this is a jump, but it almost reminds me of like Pavement's like Terror Twilight, which is like kind of their last record, kind of a wistful kind of a band that's kind of been through it. You know, a lot of this record, you know, has maybe more than the usual Radiohead level of weariness, you know.
Sure. And you got the sense in the last tour, Tom was a little tired of being the front man of a rock band. which is easy to understand.
Well, you've kind of gotten that sense for a couple decades.
Right, but now especially, he just seems like, I've had it with this shit.
I think you could see it two ways. And I did say, like, that was my thought yesterday. And to be clear, I think I'm not even sure that anyone else has said this.
I didn't credit you with that ridiculous theory.
I just want
to credit me.
Yeah, it was a thought because
I'm still smarting about your guitar dressing bad earlier.
No, I disagree.
No, it's fair enough.
I disagree. But I mean, But I think there's two ways of looking at it. I think this seems like a very significant record, and it does feel like, yeah, it could be a goodbye. Like, you know, you take all the songs that people were waiting to hear, you record them. It has this dreamy kind of like this lack of avoidance of songs for the first time. And not that they've obviously had songs for a long time, but just straightforward, fully composed songs rather than much more experimental things. And it has that, you know, valedictory tone to it. So yeah, it could be their last album, but the other way of seeing it is that maybe it's a sort of rebirth, you know, because there are moments of real joy on this album. There's moments of real, you know, there are different ways to love that whole thing. And sure. So it might be
Identikit is like one of the more up-tempo songs. Then it kind of builds into this awesome electric guitar riff at the end.
That is guitar.
Thank you, Brian. That is guitar.
That's a really cool guitar thing at the end of that. Yeah.
Thanks for saying that.
Yes. And I agree with you. That is definitely. Although it would be funny if it turns out that that's like very precisely sampled keyboards that they made to sound like guitar.
One interview that Johnny Greenwood does, say what that was.
It's hilarious that people thought that was guitars. Of course, it was not guitars.
Well, let's go into your. What are your guys' favorite songs on this? I love Desert Island Disc, which is a gorgeous acoustic song.
I mean, Burn the Witch is great. By the way, that's another song that was around since since the early 2000s. There were lyrics on it.
At least the title and lyrics, right?
Yeah, they pull the thing where they put the title and lyrics in the album art, that means it's like a song they tried to record and didn't succeed, and then they're making themselves seem all mysterious by popping it in there. So they've been working. It's another song they've been beating themselves to death to try to capture. And it's funny that was the first single when I first heard it, and I was like, it's kind of dull. It was my first reaction, but that's because basically. You were not trained in the current media environment to take in a Radiohead song like while we're working or whatever. It's really like, it's not going to be like, it actually does require, you got to put on your good headphones and kind of zone into it and really, which is one of the things that I think, a lot of people think they were trying to send a message, by the way, that this album requires a new level of attention by deleting all their Twitter presence and deleting their Facebook and deleting their website, like saying like, go offline, lie in a field and listen to this album.
And the Burn the Witch thing was sent out as just a flyer in the mail to people, a printout of just said Burn the Witch.
Right, I didn't get one. Did you get one?
I didn't get one either. I saw a picture of it on the internet.
Yeah.
Who got it?
I'm not sure mailed to who, but the point is that they went as old school as they could. They erased all of their stuff online. There was just a physical printout.
It's sort of like that joke about Marilyn Manson going door to door shocking people.
The Onion.
They're not only going back to their 90s songs, they're going back to 90s. Publicity techniques.
Yeah, like 1890s.
Wait, I think that's Tom York at the door.
Oh my gosh, what are the chances?
Wow.
And this tour is sort of interesting that last time around they did like 10 months straight playing arenas. They seem really burned out here. They're playing a few festivals. They're playing The Garden. They're playing LA, and that's it. At least for now.
Are they going to do a big show with like an orchestra and a choir and stuff?
Nobody knows anything.
Because, I mean, it does raise the question. Again, they're always making these albums. Well, and King of Limbs was impossible to play until they got an additional percussionist.
And that same guy, Clive, he just tweeted that he will be on the tour. So they will have they'll have two drummers once again.
A lot of people were mezza about their last record, The King of Limbs. Were you guys, what did you guys think of it?
It was maybe my least favorite of the post-Pablo Honey era even. It just never quite clicked for me like the previous ones.
Half a great record.
half a great record.
That's a nice hedge.
Yeah, but, for, yeah, right. but it's no good.
Well, I felt there was a weird drop off in like half of it I really liked, half of it I think they really were going for something. If you read again Frick's interview or his cover story, I mean they really felt that, like, I think for them they felt like it was as much a reinvention as Kid A, which I have little trouble hearing, I guess. But I think
for me, rhythmically, I mean, with the two drummers,
true,
for sure.
True. Mm-hmm. That is true. And it facilitates
Tom's.
They had
two ball drummers, not one.
Yes. It facilitates Tom's dancing. I guess that's the, you know.
Uh-huh.
Then, right.
I think part of it is sometimes for radio, it feels like the method is as much the point as the end result. And I think their method was radically changed from what,
right.
from what I don't even, from the descriptions I've read, I don't even quite get what they were doing, but apparently everything was extremely cut up. It was never, you know,
right.
which isn't that different than other stuff they've done, but it must have been even more extreme.
Right, but for sure, like, beginning when Tom York discovered, like, Laptop Music, that was a huge thing
yes.
for him, and they would chop stuff up. And
yes.
I'm almost thinking like Dylan talking about his mathematics.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'd need to ask them more directly and understand what the difference was. But this is not chopped up. But listen, there's electronic stuff all over this new record.
Sure.
All over this new record. It's just not the dominant aspect.
Right.
You know, there's beats everywhere. There's, you know, there's synth. There's all sorts
right.
of things, you know. And it's
definitely, yeah, it's not their unplugged record. But it's certainly, there are songs that you can imagine being just them and a guitar.
Yeah, there were
right.
even moments, honestly, when I was like, gee, you know, I might prefer this song, you know, just an acoustic guitar and Tom's voice. There were a couple songs where it's like, I don't know, maybe Nigel, like, cool it for a minute. Like, I don't know, but then I go back and forth, you know, and I'm sure even they, you know, that's a method they've occasionally resorted to, and I wondered whether there were times when they definitely went for the big orchestral thing over and over again on this record. And
right.
it did. There were times when it reminded me of, people have compared it to the two Nigel Godrich Beck acoustic records, you know, and there is something to that.
Yeah, see, that's funny.
I
really don't
about.
Hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Sea Change is such an acoustic record,
yeah.
you know, it's,
right.
it's like, that is just like, you know, Beck living in like the mid 70s, you know?
right.
I
agree. I think it's a kind of a superficial, I think there's moments when the mood for a moment seems to kind of stay in that zone, and that's when it feels most Beckian, but thankfully it always breaks out of it.
Right.
I think that that's the deeper you listen, the less it sounds like that stuff. And I also think, frankly, that the Johnny Greenwood is a much more interesting orchestrator than Beck's dad.
throwing shade at Beck's dad.
That's true. Take that, Beck's dad.
Yeah.
I love the numbers. I think the numbers is one of my favorite
songs.
Song.
Yeah.
We could keep going, but I think we might wrap it up here. You know, with any Radiohead record, you know, I think they usually take a couple months to fully sink in, so maybe we'll come back later in the year, maybe for our Records of the Year episode in December.
Sure.
But Andy Green, Brian Hyatt, thanks for coming on.
Of course.
Sometimes it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day. So if you're still making trips to the post office, you need a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official United States postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. We have a special offer where you can sign up for Stamps.com using the promo code MUSIC. You get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus, which includes postage and a digital scale. So go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in MUSIC. That's Stamps.com. And enter MUSIC.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
And that was, of course, I Put a Spell on You by Screamin' Jay Hawkins. One of his greatest hits, and maybe his greatest hit, and we have
maybe his only hit.
Maybe his only hit, and we're going to talk about that because we have the author of the new novel, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, All-Time Greatest Hits, Mark Benelli, Rolling Stone contributing editor. Thanks for coming in, Mark.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nathan.
Mark, you've been a contributing editor at Rolling Stone for around 15 years now, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I started around 2000.
And
yeah.
You've had a couple lives. I mean, you profiled everybody from Radiohead to you wrote a brilliant profile of George Clinton, which was
Really fun.
One of my favorite stories from the last couple of years. And also politics and culture, the Pope. You wrote about Pope Francis for our cover story last year, or 2 years
ago.
Two
years ago, I believe. Yeah.
And you also have another life as a novelist. You wrote Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die, which is a book I encourage anyone to check out, where you play with kind of formal devices, and, you know, you have a... Is it fair that you have a bit of a rep as a, you know, you're a writer who's willing, like, to push the form?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's true. And with both books, I think I must like the idea of taking history or real facts and kind of messing with them in some way. And I think maybe that comes out of my journalistic background.
Yeah. And that leads to your new book, which kind of blends the two sides of your life even more in the sense that on one hand, it mixes straight up music journalism about the life of Screaming Jay Hawkins and also kind of the myth and fiction. First of all, why don't you just tell me how you got the idea to write about Screaming Jay Hawkins? Like, how did this come together?
I think, you know, the main appeal for me was just the perversity of the choice. I mean, if you sort of made a mental list of musicians who would be worthy of a novel or a biography or a film biopic, I think Screaming Jay Hawkins would be way, way, way towards the bottom of most people's list. And so for me, somebody...
You're saying there isn't currently a bidding war for options over Screaming Jay Hawkins' life
right
now.
Well, it's funny you say that. A couple years ago, I was maybe halfway into the book. Jason Fine, our colleague and my longtime editor, I was talking to him on the phone and sort of complaining about how I didn't have enough time. You know, it was taking me a really long time to finish the book. And I was saying, I'm really worried, you know, because this is just a story that's out there and somebody else might just take this. And there was a long pause, and then Jason said, I don't think you need to worry about that.
And was he proven right?
He was right. But I guess at a certain point, I must have been reading the liner notes to one of his compilations. And you know, I came to Jay through I Put a Spell on You, which is the song we just heard, which is really his one hit, and it's such a great song.
And it's just like one of like the most awesomely weird novelty rock songs out that came out of the 50s. It's like one of the craziest early like rock and R&B songs out there. It just exists in this world of its own. It's been used by like Jim Jarmusch.
That's how I first heard it. It was used a lot in an early Jarmusch film, Stranger Than Paradise, which I saw years after it came out in college. And there's a character in the film who plays the song over and over. And it's just so, it's so haunting and weird. And it's a very funny song. But it's not. It's one of those rare songs that uses humor that is also manages to be kind of creepy and moving. And I feel like it's kind of a timeless song. There's a waltz. It's done in kind of a waltz, you know. Step
and crazy time signature.
And it's funny. The other day I was in a pharmacy or somewhere, and I heard an old Chuck Berry tune from the same era. And it occurred to me that song. It was a great song. I can't remember which. It was one of his big hits, but it felt very dated. Like it immediately made me think of like the 50s. Whereas I Put a Spell on You feels somehow out of time.
Almost like this is a funny comparison, but almost in the same way that some Dylan songs feel like they exist like in their own universe. I mean, this is like.
Totally.
I can't think of a song that created its own universe as much as I Put a Spell on You.
Very much so. And that was the gateway for me, I guess, to just be sort of peripherally interested in him. And then, as I was saying, at some point, I guess I was flipping through the liner notes of one of his CDs, and his biography, or at least the biography as he told it, was so bonkers and so obviously exaggerated, but also... I immediately recognized such a perfect story if it were true, you know.
Let's talk about some of like these crazy. I mean, actually, another Dylan thing. I mean, like Screaming Jay Hawkins, like Dylan, made up a lot of crazy stories about his life. So,
yes.
So do you want to tell us about some of the things that he? Yeah.
Well, he claimed that he was adopted and raised by an entire tribe of Indians in Cleveland. This would have been. He was born in 1929. He claimed that he lied about his age when he was 14 in order to enlist in World War II, and that he saw combat in the Pacific. He claimed that he was a middleweight boxing champion in Alaska. I mean, it goes on and on. And then, you know, when he died in 2000, stories came out that he had claimed that he had upwards of 75 illegitimate children. So,
and a lot of these stories were accepted. Like, you can go to his Wikipedia page, and actually, I think it still says that he actually was a boxing champion in Alaska. So you actually had to do some, you did some digging here. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. I don't know how much of this stuff is true or not.
Right.
My sort of working thesis for the book was like, let's just take him at his word for it.
Right.
And that was for me as a novelist, that was why he was such a fun subject to play around with. Like, just basically it gave me so much leeway to dip into these crazy worlds. And I kind of didn't want to know how much of this stuff was true. I suspect the seeing combat in World War II was not true. I suspect the Indian tribe, probably not true. He may have been a boxer, you know.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. A lot of these profiles, the few profiles there are of him and you know, liner notes and places like Wikipedia, they just accept a lot of this stuff at face value, which is pretty interesting.
Including, there's the story about how he recorded I Put a Spell on You.
Right, and he often told this story in interviews that he'd originally written the song as a kind of straight ballad, more in the style of that tune Pledging Your Love, which is played in a lot of like Scorsese movies. It's a very kind of croony falsetto.
Croony, almost like Charles Brown or something.
Era. And the way he told the story was that he went into the studio and the producer wasn't liking the way things were going, so he brought in a big case of wine and they all got really drunk, and then he blacked out. 10 days later, they handed him this single, and he listened to it, and he didn't even recognize it. And there were all these crazy, like, grunts and howls, and that's how he became Screamin' Jay Hawkins. And it's almost like a Marvel Comics origin story. And if you really, I don't know if that was true or not. I suspect it's not true because he was doing songs kind of like that, sort of blues shouter type songs, you know, years before. So he was playing around with that sort of singing style for a while.
Right.
So probably it just naturally evolved. But his story, his versions are always better than whatever the truth might have been.
So you wrote, I mean, this book, which I'm really enjoying, is like, it's this like kind of novelistic approach that takes him at face value and goes into each one of his major myths, right? Was that...
So many musicians... So many of the more iconic musicians have gotten this sort of film biopic treatment in recent years. I feel like there's something somewhat cinematic about the fragmented approach I did. Like, you just kind of dip in and out of scenes in his life. So, yeah, we see him in World War II. We see him touring with Fats Domino, which that is true. He did do that.
And that's a wonderful section. Like, I love your depiction of Fats Domino as, you know, the guy. And a lot of it's based on, you know, true stuff about, like, how Fats would cook for himself and his band because of Jim Crow.
Yeah.
Was that actually true, that he didn't want to, like, have to, you know, get some a cook to sneak him food from the back of a restaurant, and that's why he cooked?
Yeah, and like, I kind of researched around Jay's stories. That was my sort of MO, basically. Like, I didn't really want to know if he saw combat in World War II or not, but I did research. Like, it turns out, in fact, that people did lie about their age to fight in World War II, people as young as 14, because there was this patriotic fervor at the time. So that could have happened. You know, and then I researched, like, he claimed that he saw combat in the Pacific, so it was like, okay, where might he have been? What, you know, how segregated was the army at that time? What sorts of jobs would a black soldier at that time have gotten? And so I sort of circled his stories and tried to get the sort of surrounding details somewhat accurate. But I also, you know, I also felt like I had a lot of freedom to just make stuff up.
You said you kind of didn't want to know, like, how far did you go to actually check his name and, like, soldier roles or, like...
I didn't check that at all. I mean, there's not that much. You know, well, it's funny. At one point, very early on, I thought, you know, speaking about, like, the perversity of the choice of him as subject matter, I thought maybe I should write, like, a straight-up biography, like a well-researched rock bio of this guy who had one hit and is such an unlikely choice.
Well, and there are chapters that feel very straight up, like, all right, this is just reads like totally solid music journalism, and then you go into, like, a more, you know, novel, a very personal passage that's, like, follows his life as a child.
Yeah, and I intentionally wanted to blend all of that together. And ultimately, that's why I didn't go the biography route, because I just loved the freedom that fiction afforded me, and I felt like his penchant for myth-making really gave me the liberty to kind of make stuff up as well and kind of go crazy with that stuff.
And the fact that there really aren't any great like profiles or books written about him, right? I mean, it's kind
of... There are two good ones, but they're, you know, they're relatively short. Nick Tosh's,
right.
the great you know, music writer. He wrote, I think, two of the great music books, Dino about Dean Martin and Hellfire is one of my favorites about Jerry Lee Lewis. And he profiled Hawkins in Cream in the early 70s. And then Jerry Hershey, in her book, Nowhere to Run, which is a bunch of profiles of R&B and soul artists, she's a great profile of Jay. It's a funny story. He was opening for the Stones in the late 70s at the Garden. Apparently, James Brown was supposed to open. I can't remember what happened. He got sick or he just couldn't do it. And so, bizarrely, they chose Jay as his replacement. And Hershey describes this very funny scene of like these Stones fans just watching Jay Hawkins come out on stage and being very perplexed. But that was kind of it. And then he did, like, I looked at some later interviews, but...
He died in 2000.
He died in 2000. Just before he died, he was working on a documentary with this Greek filmmaker, and it's not the greatest doc, but that was nice to look at just to see him kind of late in life and you know, where he was at, you know, at that point.
Right. For me, it was kind of a window into a time when we just had so much less information about musicians and just celebrities in general, but especially early rock musicians who, you know, weren't incredibly famous and kind of just had that liberty to create their own myths. I mean, you also get into some of the racial issues of that time. I mean, like, as you talk about in the book, you know, Alan Freed, the famous Cleveland DJ, basically kind of helped created Screamin' Jay's, like, persona to a certain degree, which is like this crazy kind of, you know, racial stereotype.
Yeah, well, Freed, apparently, it was his idea to have Jay jump out of a coffin on stage. He was carried on stage, at least in, you know, his early days after I Put a Spell on You, in a coffin, and he would jump out of it. And then, yeah, his costume, I think that was more Jay's idea, okay. But he would dress, yeah, he put a like fake bone through his nose, and he carried the staff with a skull on it and wore these kind of crazy robes, and it was very much like a witch doctor from a really racist 40s Looney Tunes cartoon or something, you know.
Right.
So it's kind of, you know, it's problematic. The NAACP denounced him, I think, at the time. But I found it very interesting thinking about his own relation to his audience and like what he might have been intending. I mean, years later, he had a record called Black Music for White People, which is such a great title. And it just made me think about, you know, what he was playing around with and how he might have been mocking the expectations of white audiences by coming up with the shtick and this persona and saying, you know, do you think you want some sort of authenticity from me? Well, I'll give you this.
Right.
And so that was very appealing to me. And I think also having a character like Jay... A character as kind of outwardly cartoonish as Jay, where you don't really expect anything deep or heavy coming from him. Being able to explore some of these issues through a character like him, I like the unexpectedness of that quite a bit. Nina Simone very famously covered I Put a Spell on You. If you were writing a novel about Nina Simone, you would certainly get into lots of really serious issues and political stuff, and which she talked about very openly and sang about very openly. With Jay, you don't necessarily expect that when you just sort of look at him or think about him. And so for me, that was another big appeal.
Well, he had this like incredible knowing sense of humor, too. I mean, he was like this cartoon figure, right? But he also wrote that song, what, Constipation Blues, that you talk about, because there had never been a song he said about real pain.
Yeah. There's a great clip on YouTube of him performing that with Serge Gainsbourg, actually, I highly recommend. But yeah, he was really funny and really sharp. And he, you know, a lot of what he was doing was very intentional. And like you said, this is, you know, the 50s. There wasn't the same kind of music journalism happening, and like a lot of the stuff was happening under the surface, or it wasn't talked about as much. I mean, you mentioned George Clinton earlier, and he's another, I think, great character who uses humor really, effectively.
He was almost like an inheritor in a way, right, to Screamin' Jay, in the sense that he like you know, had the same outrageous costumes and persona, but was able to take it into this incredible place. He was in the 70s and was able to do something else with it.
Well, yeah, I have a great story about that. Last, you know, I did the profile of him about a year ago, which was really a treat. You know, I hung out with him in Tallahassee, where he lives now, and we took a road trip.
It's on RollingStone.com. I encourage anyone to check it out right now.
thank you. And yeah, no, it was really just super fun. And I'm from Detroit, so we kind of geeked out about, you know, his time back there, but. About a year later, just a month or so ago, I was invited to go to a literary festival in Tallahassee to read for my book, and I ended up doing an event with George. And after, I mean, a couple of funny things happened. I was reading from the book, and I think I was going on a little long, and he just suddenly started singing, "I Put a Spell on You." And so the whole audience started laughing.
Man.
And so that was a great way to kind of get heckled. I think at
no
future,
better way.
No,
right?
No, yeah. I think in future readings, I'm going to tell that story and instruct the audience that if they get bored, to just start singing, "I Put a Spell on You." But much more interestingly to me, after I finished, we went into a Q&A, and I didn't really know if George had known Hawkins. We hadn't talked about it before, but it turned out he'd seen him a bunch of times at the Apollo, which is something I write about in the book, Jace shows at the Apollo. And even weirder, during the Maggot Brain tour, apparently George jumped out of a coffin himself, and he said he was directly Whoa. Inspired by Jay.
Wow.
And he said he put his own kind of psychedelic, sort of acid-inspired twist on it. He had these chicken legs, chicken's feet hanging out of the bottom of the coffin to, like, really freak out the crowd. But, yeah, so that was really fascinating for me to sort of see that through line, which I didn't know about. But it, as you said, it totally makes sense with
Absolutely.
The theatricality of both of their acts.
It's like, well, like Screamin' Jay was only able to be outrageous in the ways that were permitted in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And you know, hopefully that world expanded. So,
yeah.
While you researched this book, was there anything that you came away with about Screamin' Jay that was like, I can't believe this is not out there in your research? Or did you?
Well, you know, one of the funnier things, you know, he got his start with a guy named Tiny Grimes. And this is an example of something that seems totally made up, but it's actually true. Tiny Grimes was a jazz guitarist of, you know, some renown. He was more of a sideman, but he played with Art Tatum and Billie Holiday. And he actually, Charlie Parker, some of his first recorded sessions were with as a sideman to Tiny Grimes. By the time Jay hooked up with him, this was before Jay had done I Put a Spell on You and sort of created his own persona. He was just working for him actually as kind of a chauffeur. But by the time Jay hooked up with Tiny, Tiny had created a kind of jive swing group, all black, but they dressed like Scotsmen. They wore kilts and like tams and like the long socks. And the group was called Tiny Grimes and His Rocking Highlanders. And so there were moments like that where, you know, that was all real, you know. And so I loved how just bizarre some of the details of the time were.
Like literally, like you can't make this stuff up.
Exactly.
At moments.
Yeah.
And it was really wide open territory.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, I encourage anyone to check this out. The name of the book is Screamin' Jay Hawkins, All-Time Greatest Hits by Mark Bonelli, Rolling Stone contributing editor and author of Detroit City is the Place to Be and Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die. Mark, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. This was great.
All right. And that was Bored to Death, the new single from the new Blink-182. We're back for our reader mail segment with associate editor Patrick Doyle. Patrick, hey. What's up?
Not too much.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. So Blink-182 are back with a new lead singer. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about this?
Well, the classic lineup of Blink is Travis Barker, Mark Hoppus, Tom DeLonge. And Mark and Tom have had a chemistry for years, going back to like 1993, that kind of the fans that you associate.
By chemistry, you mean they've had issues with each other or lack of chemistry?
Yeah. That too. But, you know, their classic songs, a lot of them are the two of them singing. Mark will sing the chorus, Tom the verse. They'd have a dynamic.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like, yeah, musical chemistry.
Yeah. But they've also not gotten along. There's been problems behind the curtain that people didn't really know about, I guess, until Blink broke up the first time around 2004. And then
I mean, Tom DeLonge has basically been kind of going his own way, right, with his group Angels and Airwaves. You just recently profiled him in the issue, and the features on RollingStone.com. It kind of gives a nice window into Tom DeLonge's eccentricities, which include, you could tell, say better than I can.
Conspiracy theories, government officials, secret meetings. He's obsessed with UFOs, so he has taken it upon himself to let the public know that, as the Blink-182 song goes, aliens exist.
and he also, he wanted to pull the band in another direction for their last album, Neighborhoods, which a lot of people had problems with. It kind of took them in a different direction.
Yeah, Travis said that, the drummer said that he was trying to make them sound like Coldplay meets U2, like this big, grand sound that Blink did not do, you know, with Take Off Your Pants and Jacket or, you know, Enema of the State, you know.
Right.
They are known as much more fun and, you know, just a punk, punk pop, you know.
So basically, Tom DeLonge is not in the group for now. He hasn't officially left. And they are going on tour, and they have a new album with a new lead singer, Matt Skiba, who was in
Alkaline Trio.
Alkaline Trio, very well-known emo punk pop group.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
It was a pretty high profile. Tell us about how people are reacting, or what do you think of the new single, and how's it going to work out?
I'm a little curious how it's going to work out, because the band, there's, you know, in interviews, they're saying this is sort of back to what we do best. And, you know, the chorus of this song is about being 17 or not being 17. It's moving past being 17, but they're sort of still living in high school. And they're 40-year-old men, you know.
It's a tough, I mean, that is a tough position. I mean, you know, you see this with groups whose most successful, most important songs are about teen life, you know.
Yeah.
It can kind of feel like they're frozen in amber.
Every Blink song, a lot of it is about high school.
Right.
And same when I think of the Strokes, you know, those guys get older. That's another band that sort of had trouble moving past being young and, you know, partying in their early 20s and that stuff. And that just at some point you don't relate to those songs anymore.
Right. It helps to write songs like Willie Nelson if you want to be playing them until 80.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little harder to be playing like songs that are, you know, more directed at 17-year-olds.
Yeah.
But let's actually, you know what, let's find out what our readers are thinking of the new Blink 182. We'll read some reader mail comments.
Mm-hmm.
First one's from Andrew Almond. The new Blink single is super bland and cookie cutter. Folks may write off Tom for being eccentric, but at least he's trying to do innovative and eclectic stuff.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. And just to go back to what we were talking about with the dynamic between Mark and Tom, it just worked so well. And this new version of Blink, I can't tell the difference, basically, between Mark and Matt Skiba when they sing a lot of the time. My friend, who's a fan, also I was texting with him, and he said that without me even saying that, he said, you know, there's two Marks. Like they don't have that chemistry where, you know, you know immediately when Tom starts singing who he is, you know?
Yeah, I think I like it a little better than you. I think
I
think it's, you know, it's pretty catchy. I think it's a really solid, like, kind of radio-friendly, like, pop-punk, you know, song. But I hear you. All right, this next letter is from a reader named Chevy Heston. I'm not into the UFO stuff. That is a reference to Tom DeLonge's interests, and was never really that much of a Blink fan. But I admire Tom for being a real artist and wanting to grow and try new things with his sound and his art, and not trying to be some 40-year-old artist rehashing the punk pop songs of his youth. There are a ton of bands out there recycling the old stuff in a desperate attempt to reclaim their fame and make a quick buck.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we've addressed some of this stuff already. I mean, it's true. On one hand, Blink are in the position of like, all right, we want to give our fans what they want. They're still a big arena band.
Yeah.
They can sell out sheds and arenas and go on major tours.
Yeah.
But doing that means that they're playing songs that were originally for high schoolers that they wrote when they were 20.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I was shocked that they are right out of the gate playing these big amphitheaters. I thought it was going to be a smaller thing, you know, because Mark and Travis had a band called Plus 44, and this is really no different than their side project.
It's interesting because it's going to be a test of kind of how much power the name has versus the actual lineup. This is something we talked about, like, you know, when Roger Waters left Pink Floyd, he tried touring and he realized his profile just wasn't as big. Just the power of the name meant a lot.
Yeah.
And David Gilmour went without him and toured as Pink Floyd with the other members and was able to sell out stadiums and arenas. So we'll see if that's true with Blink too.
It's funny that, you know, how quickly the band has sort of disowned Tom. And, like, you know, they were doing an interview with us in L.A. And Mark was saying, you know, with the previous incarnation of Blink, he was sort of just like, just, you know, talking about the last 20 years as if it were just a flash in the pan. You know?
Right. And meanwhile, there are signs that, like, Tom's been messing with them, too. He put out a press release or went on social media saying, like, I'm going to be getting back with the band on next album, on their next album. The day that their tickets went on sale, the new Blink's tickets went on sale.
Yeah, basically the day,
He said, I'll be getting back with them, kind of, which you could see that as him trying to undermine the band.
Yeah.
Right? He's saying, like, wait, this is not the real Blink. I'm going to be back.
Yeah.
Whether he intends to or not.
Yeah.
Okay, this is from a reader named Anonymous. Peace was done months ago, allegedly to be released early April. RS clearly pushed it to the week of Blink's release for their benefit.
Oh, they got us.
is this the case, Patrick?
We did have that meeting. And
the Illuminati have been planning on holding our Blink 182 story.
I've seen this a couple places, like in the comments board or somewhere else, too. I don't
Some
know where
conspiracy-minded Tom DeLonge fans.
Yeah, I'm curious where this is coming from.
Interesting. Interesting. All right. Well, can you say definitively that this was not the case?
Correct. Okay. It was not the case.
Okay. This is from a reader named FEDE018. He's too ambitious for Blink 182. He's talking about Tom DeLonge. I can see why his bandmates got fed up with him. Whatever makes him happy, you can't tie him down.
Yeah.
All right. No, you can't. Okay. And the last one is from someone named Benice Alway. UFOs are no joke. Most people are just unaware of all the documented cases and government officials who have come out to speak about them. 5 presidents, 10 astronauts, etc. I mean, the only thing I'll say to this is that, you know, UFOs technically mean unidentified flying objects.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're certainly no joke.
Right.
Because there are lots of things that are unidentified flying objects.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I want to believe that UFOs in the sense of craft from other planets, you know, that we've seen them. But I think if we had seen them, that they would, it would be a much bigger deal, that it wouldn't be something that is only that YouTube people know about or something. Because there's these videos that are always very grainy, you know.
Right, right. Well, I guess I think we're maybe seeing from these comments that there is a constituency for the Tom DeLonge strain of the original Blink members. And maybe, you know, it's not a bad move for him to, you know, pursue this for now.
Yeah, I hope he comes back, though.
Well, we'll see how this pans out over the next year. We'll see how the Blink tour does and how Tom DeLonge does with his various projects.
Yeah.
And thanks for coming on, Patrick.
Thanks, Ethan.
All right. And that's it for Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, please leave us a review at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot.
But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.